You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms
and conditions. 18 plus. Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now wherever you get your podcasts.
I feel like who Art Ed?
I'm trying to spice it.
Who Art Ed?
Mr. Wood, Art Ed, me.
Good. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's off to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, where we explore visual arts in an audio medium. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and joining me today, I have Dr. Lex, the host of the Lux Sci podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, yeah, no problem. It's a pleasure. I'm delighted to be here.
And I am delighted to be talking about somebody who knows so much about all the things I like to pretend I kind of know a thing or two about. You are a doctor of microbiology and immunology.
Yes.
But what I like is on your podcast, you're covering the fun aspects of science. You're teaching us why are sapphires blue and other colors, right? They come in other colors as well.
And a lot of other colors, yeah.
And I like that you're always answering that question of why, because I'm curious about things. I like to learn about things. I want to know not just what is, but why it is. And I appreciate that you give that to me in your podcast.
Thank you. It's part of the reason we started it. My husband and I are both scientists. We're both innately curious people. And we also have a young kid. And as your listeners with young kids know, that the why is a constant question.
Absolutely. And I am also really happy that today we're talking about Cézanne and we're getting into the arts. And one of the things growing up, I would always hear that phrase, it's more an art than a science and stuff like that. But I feel like art and science are so similar. I don't know why they get separated in people's minds, because
I don't either.
Both are a process of experimentation and learning and building off of the things that came before. And I think in a lot of ways, Cézanne is a good artist to talk about that process and that growth.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me that so many people are surprised that scientists are generally relatively artistic people too.
Yeah.
And then I would say the same thing, especially I think with the Impressionists or Post-Impressionists, right? It was all about nature and painting outside. And I think they're sort of pseudo-naturalists. If you look at, you know, Van Gogh's studies of irises or sunflowers, like I think there really is a naturalist component to that, or a little bit of a scientist in the artist as well.
Oh, absolutely. They were very much focused on optics and how we perceive color and the way that it affects the mood and all of that sort of stuff. And yeah, go ahead.
Oh, see, and the light. I mean, I think if I think about my first introduction to Impressionists, like the use of light was really, I think, what struck me the most.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what got me interested in it as well. Like at a young age, just seeing the colors and seeing the effect of those different colors juxtaposed or put next to each other. But then as I got older, the idea of color being different wavelengths of light and all of that, like just, it blew my mind in a way that, like, it took me, if I'm being honest, it took me years to really understand those concepts. Like, it was first introduced to me in elementary school, and like, I just remember hearing about it and just like calling for a timeout and just being like, that cannot be right. I know that's what the book says, but like, what's really happening here? It took me a long time to really understand that.
Do you remember when you found out that black was actually the absence of color? I was like, what?
Well, that or that black is the absence of color in an additive color model, but all of the colors mixed together make black because of subtractive methods that are, you know, absorbing some of the wavelengths of light and reflecting others. And it, again, like, I'm so happy that I have someone to nerd out with me on this stuff. As we're going to get into Cézanne. And I always like to start off with a little bit of the biography, because I think, you know, when I just read about an artist and they created this, it feels very dry to me. And where I get interested is the story. So with his story, he's born in 1839, January 19th, to be specific. His father was a banker. And I think this is one of those things that right off the bat, it kind of tells you something, because so many artists we read about and it's like, oh, they were struggling. Like Van Gogh, we referenced earlier, like Van Gogh was choosing between buying food or paint. And often he made the choice that Darwin would not have expected.
Darwin didn't study artists. Yeah. He would have had a different theory.
Yeah. But Cézanne was a very fortunate artist. He grew up the son of a banker. Even at that time, you know, bankers were pulling in a pretty healthy paycheck. I think his family actually like had their own bank. Yeah, that Cézanne's father wanted him to take over eventually. And so that would lead to some tension later on.
Yeah,
but
I can see that.
You know, he had a relatively privileged childhood. He's able to go to good schools. He went to the College Bourbon, which was probably not as fun as it would sound. Like, that sounds like an Animal House type of situation.
I'm envisioning, like, lots of, you know, wood-oaked, nice bourbons, but that's probably not what that was.
Yeah. But while he's in school, he's making friends with Emile Zola and Baptistine Bayle. I cannot pronounce it. Bye. Thank you.
Yeah, double L as an I sound in French.
Okay. See, this is why I'm talking to someone in Europe right now, because you are living your best life traveling through Greece, and I am here in my basement bunker recording on Zoom. I can never get a French name right. Or an American.
Try the Greek ones.
Really anything.
The Greek ones are tongue twisters.
But what's interesting is, like, even as a child, he's growing up with these other artists. You know, Zola was a writer, and Bai went on to teach optics and acoustics, which, know, seems like a little bit of foreshadowing there.
Yes.
But Cézanne's father wanted him to go into the family business, run the bank. He started off studying law, the respectable income-producing career path, but he always felt that pull towards the arts. And so he continued studying art on the side. In 1859, his dad bought an estate. It translates to House of the Wind. It's like Jade de Buffon.
It's pretty good. There you go. Getting it.
Yeah. But like Cézanne absolutely loved this estate. It's a grand place in I region of France. A-I-X.
It's, or maybe that one. It's always been a hard one for me. I don't think I've ever successfully pronounced that, the name of that part of France.
Yeah. I'm going to work to avoid pronouncing it for the rest of the episode, although it does come up. He lived there for years, and he loved painting that house, the trees around it. In 1860, his dad actually gave him permission to paint big murals in the drawing room.
Ooh, nice.
So it's not like a situation where his dad was saying, forget all about the arts, but he definitely wanted him to do something else professionally. And so in 1861, when Zola urged Cézanne to dedicate himself fully to art, that did lead to a falling out with his father.
I can see that.
Yeah. they did reconcile. The gist of it seems to have been that basically his dad approved once Paul agreed that he was going to dedicate himself earnestly to studying the arts. So it wasn't going to be like a situation of, I am a rich kid, I'm going to, you know, live off the family wealth, and maybe every once in a while I'll make a painting that can hang up in a cafe and I'll call myself an artist. Like, he wasn't that, like, hipster stereotype. Like, he legitimately studied art. And he did. Like, he not only went to art school, although he was rejected from art school two times.
Oh, man.
He did go to art school. He persisted with it. He took that study seriously, and he continued in his studio practice to be very methodical. I mean, like, when we talk about other people of that day, like, Monet was trying to capture his first impression and paint as quickly as he could to capture that fleeting light. Cézanne was much more methodical. He would take much more time developing his compositions.
You can tell, too. The style is, it does feel very different from, you know, others that were going on at the time. Although, you know, what's interesting to me as you're talking, I was sort of thinking that so many of the really great French artists of the time had that sort of place that they went for inspiration, right? So it was Arles for Van Gogh, and it was Giverny for Monet, the gardens at his place in Giverny. So it's interesting that there's this kind of, they're painted elsewhere, but there's these poles to kind of a natural setting that they felt really comfortable in.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think, you know, it makes sense, the repetition of these similar subjects. We're going to be talking about Cézanne's painting of Mount Saint Victory. I don't know. You know, we're talking about his painting there. He made like 30 paintings of that mountain. And you talk about Monet with Giverny. You know, he did 250 water lilies, just water lilies. That's not even like including all the other stuff he did in that garden. Like, at first it seems like, man, these people are obsessed. But at the same time, like, if you think about it, I think that's human nature. I think we all find comfort in these things that we go back to over and over and over again. Like, look at your Spotify playlist. How often are you getting the same songs coming up? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Or even just, it speaks to their dedication. Like you're saying, Cézanne was a hard worker. He took it very seriously. And all these artists did, I think, right? And it was a comfort. And I think it was all that. It was also the perfectionism, like getting the light just right, getting the color just right. You know, to be able to do. There's this really beautiful quote from Van Gogh in one of his letters to his brother, talking about the sunflowers and how they wilt by the end of the day. So he only had just so much time to capture them perfectly. And I think that's why he did them so frequently, is because he couldn't sit there, and you can't take a sunflower and spend days painting it. You have a limited amount of time. So he'd just do it over and over again.
Yeah, because with the practice comes improved skill and improved speed, and probably a certain amount of frustration of trying to get it, and then you run out of time.
Yeah, I am full disclosure, not the artist in the family. I have a brother who's quite talented, and so I don't share that particular frustration. But maybe it's sort of like an experiment gone wrong. I spent so much time, and then it just all comes out a mess in the end.
Well, as an artist of nowhere near their caliber, what I can say is, like, I do feel like the things that I struggle with in some ways are things that just hold my attention, because it's that challenge, you know? You feel that drive to you know, reach the next level, reach the next plateau. You're captivated by something that doesn't come so easily to you. At least that's my experience and what I've heard from a lot of other people. And, you know, Cézanne, he was a worker. He felt that need. It wasn't like, you know, there's some artists you read about and it's like, okay, well, they're painting a commission. They needed to do this. They needed them to pay the bills. Cézanne inherited 400,000 francs. So he really never had to worry about money. It was more about what he wanted to accomplish for himself.
Yeah. And that's a huge sum of money back then.
It would be a huge sum of money today, but like back then, it's just an almost incomprehensible amount.
Yes.
So
I wonder what happened to, this is a scientist in me. I have so many questions. Like, I wonder what happened to the bank. Did it get taken over?
I think it was a situation where it was like, I think, you know, his father passed away. The bank, you know, it went to somebody else to run. And it was probably bought out of his share. You know,
this is what happens when you do a podcast with a scientist. Like, oh, I have so many questions.
I always have so many questions. I'm going to be going to you with more questions too.
Sure.
So like, you know, just to sort of wrap up this little bit about his background and how he got where he was. As I said, he applied to Beaux-Arts. He was rejected, I think, twice. He ended up going to the Academy Suisse. I don't know.
Suisse.
Yeah. So he ended up going to the Academy Suisse, which, you know, it was more open and accepting of different artists. That's where he met Pizarro. So, you know, he's learning from other great artists, and I guess great artists in the lens of history. But at the time, it was just like some other dude who was a little bit older and also making paintings that nobody was buying at that time. But, you know, he struggled for a little bit, and then he went back. He worked at the bank for a little while. He did almost give up on the arts because he was rejected by Beaux-Arts multiple times, but he just felt that drive to create. And as he met other artists, you know, Renoir, Monet, they actually, all of them were rejected by the Academy. And so they, in 1863, the people who were just tired of being rejected by the Paris Salon set up the Salon of the Rejected next to the official salon. And so but in hindsight, it's like it's full of some of the greatest artists we know of that time period. You know, Cézanne obviously was there. That's why I'm mentioning it in this story. But so was Monet, Manet, Pizarro, like, it was quite the show of these people that were not doing the traditional academic studied historical paintings that were celebrated in that time. They were the avant-garde. They were a little bit ahead of their time doing stuff that was derided as sloppy and not fully polished, completed paintings.
Yeah. If you sort of, so you might be able to tell, I took French in school. We did a little bit of French art history as well. And if you see kind of what comes before the Impressionist and Post-Impressionist period, it is really quite a departure from the sort of the previous norms of paintings.
Can see
where they'd be like,
Yeah, but I always like to talk about whenever I feel like longtime listeners are going to be bored with this fact, but for anyone who hasn't caught the older episodes, whenever I talk about the Impressionists and Post-Impressionists, I always like to think of it in that historical lens of, you know, how technology shapes our world and what our priorities are. Yeah. Because if we talk about, you know, just in the historical timeline, 1860s, give or take right here, for the Impressionist movement, you know, the daguerreotype, the photographic process, was kind of a new innovation. That's mid-19th century as well. And so those really early photos in like 1840s, you're talking very long exposures, black and white, but the camera fairly quickly improved in the abilities as they started to make prints on other media and got away from the mercury vapors and stuff like that. But the camera at that time was able to capture the light and shadow. It's able to capture the line, the shape, the forms, the proportions much more accurately than any painter could in a fraction of the time. What the camera couldn't do was capture the color. It couldn't capture the emotion. It couldn't capture the mood. It couldn't do these abstractions that take human intelligence. And that's where we saw European painters shift from trying to capture an accurate likeness into, you know, capture the mood, capture the colors, capture the feel.
Well, you know, what's interesting that you say about that is we talk about capturing the colors. So up until the 1800s and around the time of Van Gogh and Cezanne, color was a really hard thing to capture. There was no good green, really. There really wasn't a good orange. And there was a good blue, but it was made up of ground lapis lazuli. It's called ultramarine. And so it was ridiculous expensive. And
I believe so more valuable than gold.
Yeah, at one point. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that is people kind of say like, oh, you just ground up the lapis and throw it in. At the time they would have been using, not in for Cezanne, but earlier they would use egg yolk as the base.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't, if you just ground lapis lazuli, you get gray because lapis is a mixture of lazurite, which is the blue, and then like fool's gold or calcite, which is a white and a gold streaks in it. So you actually have to do this really complicated extraction process to get the lazulite out before you could grind it up. And that made it even more expensive is because it had to be processed as well as being just rare in general.
Yeah. If I read correctly, I think for like every kilogram of lapis lazuli, they would get, what is it, like 3 grams?
Yeah.
I mean, it's
it was crazy.
You know, most of my audience is an American, so like kilograms and grams. The rest of the world that uses logical math system knows this, but a kilogram is 1,000 grams.
Yeah.
And three, so out of every 1,000, you're only getting 3 usable. Yeah. Like that's an insane ratio there.
Yeah, but then in the 1800s, they got so sick of this that the French Industrial Society offered a 6,000 franc reward to who could come up with a synthetic version. And so somebody did.
And that's where we get the French ultramarine.
French ultramarine, which artists don't like as much because when you grind up something like lapis lazuli, since it's a natural mineral, everything is going to, the particles are going to be different sizes. And that actually adds depth to the paint because the light refracting is going to refract in different ways from the different particle sizes. When you make French blue, you end up with particles of all the same size. So the criticism of French blue for ages is that it's been flat, essentially,
yeah.
When you use it as a color. The color is correct, but the depth of the paint is off. So in the 60s, Yves Klein worked with a chemist to develop a resin. So a resin medium instead of like an oil-based medium. And so this allowed the depth to approach the original ultramarine.
Yeah, and he developed what is known today as International Klein Blue. And
yes.
Yves Klein, mm-hmm. it's a beautiful blue. It you know, has that depth to it, but it is his patented color. And,
yes.
You know.
But ultramarine was so prized because it's what they call a true blue. Like it doesn't have any green undertones,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of rare. So, but yeah, but they did come up with a okay green and a sort of okay orange. And we can talk about, if you'd like to, the green is really interesting because it's incredibly toxic, but we can talk about the painting first.
Is that Scheele's green?
Yeah, Scheele's green.
So again, this is right around the same time. I did a mini episode a while back, probably a year ago, about killer wallpaper and Scheele's green. But that is the same time period as they're developing these synthetic pigments.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the Impressionists and Post-Impressionists embraced those synthetic pigments because all of a sudden it's all these colors that are widely accessible. And as you said, there were some people who were like, I don't know if it's the same depth of color, but the other thing is there's the, like, how is it going to hold up over time?
Mm-hmm.
Because some of those colors, as they're exposed to ultraviolet light and all of that, they're going to fade more, especially mm-hmm. if it's a dye-based pigment mm-hmm.
yeah.
compared to a mineral-based, you know, when we talk, and for people that, I should let you explain the short version of the difference between a dye-based and a mineral-based pigment, you know, just so we understand that as a reference point.
Yeah, I mean, it really is just where does it come from? So, you know, like I said, lapis lazuli is a mineral that's ground, well, the lazurite is extracted and that mineral is ground into a powder and put into a base, such as an oil base or a resin base, the properties of that mineral mean that it adheres a little bit better to a wide variety of canvas,
yeah,
pots, I mean, whatever substance you want to use. Dye-based, because you're extracting the dye usually from a plant, and you're extracting smaller molecules, essentially proteins, right, that account for the color of the plant. The adherence property, I think, is just more variable. Although I will say the mineral ones can be a little bit variable too. So like chromium yellow, well, it adheres really well, but it turns dark over time.
Yeah.
So again, you know, keep going back to Van Gogh's sunflowers, but chances are they were much more yellow when he first painted them, and they just kind of turn brownish as the paint interacts, because there's the adherence properties, and then there's also the interaction properties of the compound, right? So it, something could stick really well, but then also be a little bit what we call excitable, where it likes to interact with other things. It's like, oh, look at that, another molecule. I'm going to go over and say hello. And then it's interacting with the air, and it's changing color, and it's changing.
Interesting.
Kind of the depth of the paint. And there's things that are really inert, or they're just like the introverts of the chemical world. They're like, no, I'm good over here by myself. I don't need to be with anybody else. We're fine.
Okay. So that's really interesting. This is one of those moments where I'm having that realization of a gap in my knowledge and my history, because I always thought of it in this very simplistic term. I always thought of it in terms of like a mineral-based pigment. It's basically a ground-up rock, you know, mm-hmm. whereas a dye is a ground-up plant. And what's going to break down faster? The plant. But then, because I was always thinking of primarily the way that things fade because of exposure to light. Mm-hmm. But then as I'm hearing you explain this, I had the realization that, of course, there are other chemical reactions because the atmosphere and, you know, the bonding of other elements from the air, essentially, is mm-hmm. going to cause a chemical reaction that's going to alter the colors. Just like, you know, in a photographic chemical reaction, you've got the silver compounds that are reacting and changing colors. I mean, you know, obviously it's a very different process here, but one of the variables here is the way that those elements are going to interact with mm-hmm. other things colliding with them.
Yeah, because you have some really long lasting plant dyes too, right?
Yeah.
You see them in textiles from thousands and thousands of years ago.
I love all that stuff about color. And the Impressionists and Post-Impressionists did too. So after the break, we're mm-hmm. going to get into looking at how those different colors were applied in Cézanne's painting, Mont-Saint-Victory. I still will never get that name right. I'm going to have you say it after the break.
Okay.
You find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Calm Cove podcast can help you sleep deeply all night long. Calm Cove has deeply relaxing meditation music and ambient sounds like ocean waves and crackling fires. All of our episodes are designed to help you relax and to fall asleep fast. Calm Cove is brought to you by the team behind Sleep Cove, the sleep podcast that consists of spoken word hypnosis, meditation, and stories. So if you want to listen to a beautiful soundscape tonight, search for Calm Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see how we're helping millions of people relax and go to sleep every night. Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Sleep Cove podcast can help you. Hi, I'm Christopher Fitton, the voice and clinical hypnotherapist behind Sleep Cove. Sleep Cove features sleep hypnosis, meditations, and bedtime stories, all designed to help those of you who struggle at night to achieve a restful and peaceful night's sleep. Search for Sleep Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see why Sleep Cove helps millions of people sleep deeply all night long.
Okay, so what is the Victoire?
Mont Sainte Victoire.
Victoire. Okay, yeah. Mont Sainte Victoire.
Saint.
Still wrong.
Okay. French is not. It's a lot of weird nasal sounds that you don't normally make in English.
Shockingly enough, I did not study French. I am a typical American. I speak English and I speak bad Spanish. I know how to say, like, I'm sorry, you're going to have to slow down because I don't really speak the language. But looking at this painting, what's jumping out at you as you look at this? Like, you know, I noticed the blues and I wonder why the sky is the same blue as the mountain. Why doesn't the violet light scatter through the atmosphere? It's higher energy.
It is higher energy. That is very true. Then there's two reasons for this. One is that the sun doesn't actually produce as much violet light. It produces more blue light in the spectrum. And the second is that our eyes are actually really highly tuned to blue as opposed to violet. And so we don't see violet light. We can see purple, but that's usually the refraction of the blue and the red as opposed to actual violet light.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Cause you know, we've got the red, green and blue cones in the eyes, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Essentially. Okay. So we're seeing those lovely blues in the skies. Mm-hmm. What else is jumping out? As you look at this, what do you see? What do you notice?
Yeah, I think for me, again, having just done this deep dive into pigments recently, like the green, it's so green. And I think that having read how long it took to get a good green pigment makes me appreciate it more, actually.
Yeah.
And I really love the brush techniques that he's using to evoke a sense of a town and to evoke a sense of a forest without being so literal about it, which I guess is the whole impressionist thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like there is something about the brush technique. Mm-hmm. The way that he's moving the brush, each brush stroke is essentially defining like a plane.
Yeah.
Right? Like the brush strokes go along with the different planes. And when I say plane, I mean plane in like the geometric sense of like a two-dimensional surface. Mm-hmm. So we've got like the horizontal plane of the ground, the vertical planes of the mountain.
Yeah.
And Cézanne, as an artist who was very methodical, was known to describe like trying to paint nature and reduce things to these simple geometric mm-hmm. forms. He tried to reduce things to, you know, a sphere, a cone, a cylinder, a cube, and
yeah.
be very almost scientific, analytical of what he's seeing in front of him.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And it's, to me, it evokes a lot of just intention. Because if you're going to evoke, you know, a whole forest just by like singular brush strokes in a plane, like if you're really intentional about those brush strokes, right, you can't just kind of go wherever you want. To me, I think there is a lot of science in this painting. If you're talking about perspective and geometry and getting that to where it's pleasing to the eye. And that's not an easy thing to do. And we tend to think there should be sort of a mathematical way. But it turns out if you are, for example, a logo designer or web designer, and you use the mathematical formulas embedded in a program to lay out a logo, say, or a business card, oftentimes it looks wrong to us. And so people will kind of tweak it here, tweak it there to make it look better. So it's interesting to think about all of the things that have been going through his head as he was painting this and trying to get what he considered to be a perfected look.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the reason that he kept going back to that mountain. Also, mm-hmm. as I said, he painted it like 30 times. And
wow.
I think of it because, you know, it's probably, it was looming large over his town. You know, it's not the biggest mountain out there, but, you know, for that region, for that area, it was the biggest feature of the landscape. Mm-hmm. But also, from what I've read, Cézanne was just really fascinated by the way that you could see the rock forming like these different planes. You know, mm-hmm. you could see the different faces to the mountain.
Yeah.
And he was trying to capture that and capture that just right. And I think what's also interesting as I'm looking at this, I get this sense of almost like the atmospheric perspective in terms of like the mountain is receding into the sky because, you know, this is a little bit of a distance view mm-hmm. of that mountain. We're looking across houses we're looking across the landscape and the mountain is the farthest point that we can see. And it's receding into the blues of the sky. From a distance, it's almost like the mountain and the sky become one.
Yeah.
The whole landscape almost, if you were far enough away, it almost becomes kind of like a Rothko type of work or something like that, where it's just these fields of different colors.
Yes.
You know, it's broken into these bands that are kind of interesting.
So did you know that the reason that there's always clouds over mountains, especially ones of a certain height, right? So you have the leeward side and the windward side of a mountain. So like the windy side and the sheltered side, right?
Yeah.
On the windward side, the air is rushing up and cooling as it rises because the atmosphere is thinner. And when the air cools, it can't contain the water droplets anymore because the molecules are getting compressed. And so it forms a little cloud. And that's why even despite whatever other weather is around it, mountains of a certain altitude will always have like a little cloud.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And so we see those little allusions towards clouds in here, yeah. too, as he's doing those little gray brush strokes and stuff like that. I guess I never noticed that before, but as you say it, it makes sense. And again, that's getting at like just the way that all of these different elements are coming together in these surprising ways that he's picking up on. He's studying, mm-hmm. and Cézanne was not like Monet going to paint it in one moment. Monet was trying to capture a moment in time.
Yeah.
And I love this comparison, and I'm not going to try to take credit for it. I read it somewhere, can't remember the source, but someone said, while Monet was trying to capture a single moment in time, Cézanne was going back repeatedly to make something that was truly timeless.
Mm.
That he's showing multiple days and multiple seasons and multiple times of day in this work. It becomes the synthesis of different views.
Right. And you can kind of see that because to me, I get a sense of movement of the clouds across the mountain, like kind of like a time-lapse photography, right? We have really fast. And I think because he's using to the lighter gray on the right side of the painting and then moving into a darker gray, you do get the sense of time of, twilight kind of coming in and, you know, that it's about to get dark. That's what I sort of pick up with the clouds. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's just this interesting tension to me as I look at it, because on the one hand, it feels very studied and analytical, and at the same time, it feels almost calm, or like it feels in some ways a relaxed painting, you know, because of the visible brush strokes and because of all of that, it feels a little bit playful, but also it's, you know, played out by somebody who has clearly thought and practiced and deliver about everything for so much time.
So question for you, if I may, since I'm not an artist. So the use of deliberate brushstrokes, how much of a choice is that? How much is it influenced by what brushes you have access to? How much is it influenced by just whether the artist, like how hard is it to not see a brushstroke in a painting? It seems to me that'd be very hard to not see that at some level.
No, it's 100% a choice. If you look at his earlier work, it was actually less brushy. Mm. His stuff became more about the brushstrokes as he went on. One of the sort of modern ideals that was out there was sort of truth to materials. And I think one of the most, when I think of Cézanne, I think of one of his most interesting ways of conceptualizing a painting that was different from a lot of other people was like prior to the Impressionists and Post-Impressionists, you know, like prior to this time period, as we've already talked about, artists were trying to capture exactly what a person, place, or thing looked like. You know, right. that naturalism was prized, and we wanted as little evidence of the painter as possible. And then the Impressionists, like Monet, were trying to capture that fleeting moment. But Cézanne, he was looking at this and saying, you're not looking at a landscape. You're looking at my painting of a landscape and making us consciously aware of the painting process as this thing that is coming between us and what's there. You know, he's putting the painter in that process as centrally on view. And that was kind of a rejection of the technique that had been taught for years and decades prior to that. So like he was fully capable of blending his colors, right. Largely because oils stay wet for so long. You can layer and you can blend and you can do these glazes that become more and more invisible in terms of the process. It's labor intensive. It's hard to do
sounds
it.
Sounds like it.
It's hard to do it well the way that, say, Michelangelo or a Raphael, or I guess, you know, really a good example would be like a Van Eyck, you know, because Van Eyck was definitely working in oils for a long time and doing those glazes and stuff like that. But but Cézanne was saying, like I said, you're not looking at this mountain. You're looking at my painting. Mm-hmm. And my painting is about these brushstrokes that are defining these planes. And we describe works like this as very painterly, where it's about the fact that it's painted. You know, that's a part of the work.
Yeah, I love it. So do you think that Cézanne really fits into that sort of classic definition of impressionist? It seems like he had a little bit of a different view than, say, a Monet.
When I'm talking to kids, I usually will lump impressionists and post-impressionists together. What I think for me, the sort of dividing principle between them was impressionists were largely about their gut reaction, immediate response to that fleeting moment. Mm-hmm. It's trying to capture that first impression. Whereas the post-impressionists were going at something a little bit different. It was a little bit more cerebral. It was less about the optics and the color theory and stuff like that. It was more about the study of the scene. And, you know, in the case of Van Gogh, he's heightening the emotion.
Yeah.
In this case, he's getting a little bit more conceptual about what is art? Is this a reproduction of nature, or is this something to be viewed? And is this about the artistic process and all of that? I put Cézanne more in the post-impressionist camp as I think about it, but I also, to a certain extent, feel like, and I probably shouldn't say this because my other podcast, Art Smart, is all about different movements and eras in art history. But those labels, I think, are reductive in a way that's not always helpful to the conversation.
Right, right.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
It's a schema that gives us a good foundation. But it becomes problematic if we allow that to become a ceiling to our learning in it.
I feel like art is like nature. Classification is always going to be challenging.
it's like, you know, talking about describing any human is always going to be, you know, they fit in a lot of different categories. Mm-hmm. You know, I am an art teacher. I am a parent. I am, you know, like a community member. Like I'm a lot of different things. We all occupy these different roles to varying degrees. But if I were to simplify him and put him in one category, I would put his work in the post-impressionist category. And I'm wrapping it up. I want just a 3-point rating scale. And where should this hang? The Louvre? Is this something to look at? The lab? Is this something to learn from? Or the Louvre? British for the bastard.
Yeah.
There's the Louvre joke in there somewhere.
Oh, that's terrible.
I would put this in the Louvre. I think it's a beautiful representation of his work. And having been to the Louvre, I did not get to see the whole thing.
I don't think it's possible to see the whole thing. I think I've seen stuff that says like to go through the entire Louvre and see every piece, it would take you like weeks just to go like one second per piece.
Yeah, I would. I think it's a gorgeous painting. And like, for all the reasons that we've talked about, although I would love to have it in the lab. I am a huge proponent of art being in public places where everyone can see it.
Yeah, I mostly agree. I would actually put this one in the lab because I think there's a lot to learn from it. I think the way that he's composing his images, I can and have learned from. I've looked at quite a few of his works. I've enjoyed it. If I'm going to be 100% honest, I don't like this one.
No, it's good. That's what art is.
I picked the Mont Saint-Victor, hopefully got that, from 1902 from 1902 to 1904, because as a teacher, I want to try to cover as many from the AP art history list as possible. And this one's on that list. But I'm going to say that I disagree with the testing people. I don't think this is his best. I don't think it's his most significant. It's fine. The brushstrokes, the technique is great. I think there are others that are more aesthetically pleasing. And so,
which one is your favorite?
I like his still lives. I like his still lives. I like, you know, his handling of fruit, the apples and all of that. Like I like the table that's a little bit disjointed and as I said, you know, that slight mix of perspectives that is just like it's yelling at the viewer, you're not looking at a bowl of fruit. And I think that was a bold stance for him to take as an artist. Like I liked that. And this also could be bias coming in because, you know, those were some of my first exposures and, you know, you tend to be comfortable with things that you've seen so many times and the museum pieces that you've seen in person. You know, I went to the Art Institute of Chicago, so pieces that are in the Art Institute's collections are often my favorites, you know. This one, it's fine, but I learn from it more than I enjoy it.
Well, yeah. So next time you have it in the lab, you should use some polarized light microscopy so you can find out exactly what pigments he used for it.
I would absolutely love to. The way that I first got into podcasts and listening to them was, you know, listening to a lecture that I cannot find, but I stumbled across in the very early days of like the iTunes store on my old iPod. And it was just all about the history of different pigments and how they were developed. And,
So I
specifically remember hearing about how the French ultramarine was developed and why it was developed and whoever that college lecturer was that put their stuff out online for free for everyone, thank you. It definitely created this thirst for me to just know more. Because you always think this stuff's around, but like even tubes of paint, like that was a 19th century invention.
Yes.
Before that, it was glass vials and the pig's bladder. You know, it was not exactly convenient.
And you had to be friends with an alchemist. if you wanted the good colors.
there's so much stuff that is just, it's bananas to think back on it, but that's how people lived. That's what they knew. Mm-hmm. And it shapes the way that we perceive everything. Well, I do want to say thank you once again, Dr. Lex, the host of the Lux Sci podcast.
Yes. You're very welcome. And thank you. This is super fun.
And I highly recommend listeners, if you enjoy the show and want to learn more about the science behind the arts and why things are the way they are, check out the Lux Sci podcast. I am going to link it in the show notes.
Thank you.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted, part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you found this tolerable, please leave a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week on social media at Who Arted Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and of course on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.